The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, everybody. This is President Donald Trump. It has now been 100 days. I am the greatest president in the history of presidents who's ever presidented. I have done more victory rallies than any other president. By the way, we have the highest ratings of any presidency ever.
Hello, and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man the White House claims is not afraid of stairs.
Not afraid of stairs. Nope.
Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. I'm here with my co-host, Virginia Heffernan, the author of Magic and Loss, Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie. You may also have seen him on the show Donald Trump calls Deface the Nation.
We're fake news. It's fair.
We're here on the last night of the Tribeca Film Festival. The smell of popcorn in this theater is overwhelming. I think we're the last event of the 12-day Tribeca Film Festival. We have a fantastic crowd here. As Donald Trump likes to say, there's lines around the block. Well, maybe not quite. So the stairs thing, that was kind of weird, right? I think that got started when Theresa May was visiting and Donald Trump kind of grabbed her arm on some stairs, and the British tabloid started this thing like Donald Trump is afraid of stairs.
Well, it was weird. Everyone was correcting for something because people didn't want to think that Theresa May and Donald Trump had gotten cozy. So then they maybe invented the fiction, much more palatable fiction, that he's afraid of stairs, of which I think there were two. And and thus had to steady himself on her arm, lest we think that the special friendship had been rekindled between the two nations.
Nothing to it, Jamel. He kind of does when he's going down from the plane. He kind of grabs that. Right.
I mean, there are not that many images or videos of Donald Trump going downstairs. So A. But B, when we do see him going downstairs and such, he seems like very nervous. So nervous, in fact, that he leaves his wife behind trying to deplane Air Force One. So, you know, I'm not confident enough to say in print that Donald Trump is afraid of stairs. But if you, like, ask me in a casual conversation, hey, Jamel, is Donald Trump afraid of stairs? Absolutely. 100%.
You know, I really also, to be fair, I do think that that incredibly deeply reported Times article that came out in the first couple of weeks said something about maybe Kellyanne Conway being on the second floor. Am I getting this wrong? Because he'd probably never see her because he was, quote, afraid of stairs. And I mean, this was the failing of your Times, but I mean, I don't think they ever issued a correction.
Well, there you have it.
This is not actually our first topic.
Yeah, you said move that one along, right?
Yeah, exactly. Our first topic, and we're gonna do three big topics, and then we're gonna take some questions from all of you. We're gonna mix it up. But the first topic is the big one. After 100 days, is Donald Trump less dangerous than we thought? That is he turning out to be merely an ineffectual president, as opposed to the threat to democracy that we've all been talking about for like a year and a half? And I'll just start this out. I kind of think that, and I'll give you a couple reference points. One is first of all, you know, a key factor is 100 days. He has gotten no really major or significant legislation through Congress at all. Although there is still the possibility of something happening with healthcare. They're starting to beat the drums again next week. But I was reading today's New York Times, one of the 100 days stories I've read in the last 2 days. And this was Peter Baker writing today. I thought this was pretty convincing. He said, presumably Mr. Trump will remain impulsive and even impetuous, but he's also been open to advice. He was talked out of lifting sanctions on Russia, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, abandoning the One China policy, tearing up the Iran nuclear agreement, reversing the diplomatic opening to Cuba, closing the export-import bank, declaring China a currency manipulator, and in recent days, terminating the North American Free Trade Agreement. So, like, all that stuff, and there's lots of other stuff, too, that we were afraid he was going to crazily do, reversing all sorts of sane and sensible policies. Those are just foreign policy examples. Mm-hmm. he doesn't seem to actually be going through with any of it.
Yeah, I mean, this has definitely been, I think, a leitmotif of the show since the inauguration, but even before it a little bit, was like, was he sort of superficially scary and annoying, but not the dangerous president that, say, George W. Bush was, with a high body count and a crashed economy. And I feel like we're always asking, revisiting this question. Like, I remember asking Steve Call about Rex Tillerson this way, you know, is he going to be dangerous like Condoleezza Rice was because he's ideologically driven, or is he going to be dangerous because he does nothing, or is the actual fear that he just won't be able to do anything, he'll be so constrained? He said the second. But I think ineffectual and dangerous are not mutually exclusive. So you have a president that's checked out, or that's worried about his ratings, or that's caught in a snit all the time, like Trump is. And there are things that can happen outside of an impetuous move by the U.S. president. I mean, there might be a war elsewhere. He certainly isn't capable of making things any better in Syria. There could be currency markets failing because of something else that happens in the world. He's not going to do any good for the refugee crisis. He's probably going to make things worse. And anything that, any intention that anyone had about along right or left wing lines about improving our plight as Americans is not something that he's going to be able to help with, and he may be leaving us vulnerable to dangers from abroad too.
Right. If you're going to have a scale of like disaster from the George W. Bush presidency on like the world historical disaster side to like the fire festival, mm-hmm. and like the hilarious fuck up side.
I knew you were going to get that first.
I'm trying to really work.
He's
that
got
in.
Seriously Ja Rule stuff he's been working on.
But so. that's on the embarrassment, but not,
right,
not
embarrassment. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he's closer to Ja Rule than I think like any president should be.
governments in the Bahamas have fallen over less than that.
I think it is worth saying two things. The first is that the extent to which he hasn't gone through with his most disastrous impulses, and I don't call them plans or ideas, they're really just impulses. I'm going to do this because Obama did this and I want to negate him. That he hasn't gone through with them, to me, is indicative of what is genuinely scary about Trump in the event of a crisis, which is that he is easily convinced. He doesn't know anything. And so if a strong enough voice says something to him, he tends to go in that direction. In this case, the voices have been voices for stability and continuity with the previous administration. And so we've escaped any kind of disaster. It's interesting that his biggest single legislative disaster, which is the American Healthcare Act, he went on that path, which was obvious to anyone with half a brain, that trying to reshape 17% of the United States economy in 3 weeks is just not a good idea. I mean, like, this is like, getting started, sure. Like, yeah, you take your time. But to do it in a 3-week period, bad idea. Paul Ryan almost certainly made a very persuasive sounding case to Donald Trump that you have to do it that way. And when asked about it, Trump would say, oh, Ryan said we had to do it this way. If the Trump administration finds itself in a genuine crisis, I don't know how I feel that Donald Trump is easily moved by strong voices, especially if the crisis requires a deft touch or involves issues that his cadre of advisors just like are the wrong people to be listening to. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I think we should not forget that much of the damage of the Trump administration, even in its first 100 days, has less to do with Trump and more to do with the people he's put to head up government, head up the cabinet agencies, and in particular, Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III has been aggressive about deportations, about using the Department of Justice, along with sort of John Kelly at Homeland Security, who has ICE under his jurisdiction. They've both been aggressive about going after immigrant communities and unauthorized immigrants. And so that, I think, if nothing else, the use of state power against disfavored minorities is going actually pretty smoothly for the Trump administration. And we should always keep that in mind, that for all the hilarious disasters going on in the Oval Office, there's still this that is very real and very sort of transformative to how we think about the United States.
But I don't want to totally default to optimism here, but we do see an arc, right? I mean, at the beginning, when he first came in, he took advice from the crazies around him, Steve Bannon, Steve Miller. He signed this Muslim ban, or the travel ban, as he later started calling it. It was a disaster, PR, politics, thrown out by the courts. He's been trying to defend it ever since. But since then, he does seem to be taking more better advice from less crazy people. So Mathis, his sound Secretary of Defense, McMaster, his sound National Security Advisor. And on the NAFTA thing, I mean, it was just a classic example. He went into this call saying he was about to pull out of this treaty and said, well, you know, they were kind of reasonable and asked nicely. So I said I wouldn't. I'd negotiate instead.
Do you not find that so troubling?
I find, but I'll tell you what I would find more troubling. If he actually pulled out of NAFTA. So I don't care what kind of ridiculous improvisation gets him out of the corner he's put himself in. I care that he doesn't go through with it.
I just feel very weird that he's like Mr. Bagooing himself into into sort of like sensible-ish.
Yeah. That might be the verb of the night.
But also, I'm not sure that we can call it after 100 days a straight trajectory from, you know, the arms of Steve Bannon to the arms of his son-in-law. He supposedly has let Bannon back in a little bit. Certainly the rhetoric of the rally was Bannon-esque and was, you know, quite incendiary again and was old Donald Trump. He's an agent of chaos. And I think, I've said before that if we think of him like an alcoholic father, he can be abusive, and then he can also just be neglectful. And the Muslim ban, it's not that the Muslim ban didn't have no effects. The Muslim ban was a mess. And it's still, airports and families are still reeling from what that weekend was. And people are still afraid of traveling here and if they can leave. And it did a really nice job of instilling terror into the population that it was designed to instill terror in. It's just that chaos that, like, I can hit you in the face. He did this on The Apprentice. You know, I can, it looks like I'm going to fire you. No, I'm going to fire you. You know, it looks like I like Jared now. No, now I'm back to liking Stephen Miller. And I think he's going to be chaotic like that. And I think it's going to be crazy making. You know, the hope is that it's not crazy making for people in the press. The hope is that we can stay enough detached that we, don't fall back in love with him just because, you know, he brought mommy roses this one time, or he brought Ivanka a Syria intervention.
Here's how we know Bannon's not coming back. He dresses like a slob. Mm. Everybody knows that you get no respect from Donald Trump unless you dress like Jamel. Jared dresses like Jamel. He's running the show. Bannon looks like he slept in his clothes.
And that's it. That's the only problem with Bannon.
Trump is never going to listen to you if you look like an unmade bed like that. And it's amazing that Bannon hasn't figured that out.
Yeah, he could at least tape his tie. I mean, do you think this idea that Bannon might be making a comeback? Or some of the rhetoric of the rally and his... the claim of his many successes, his world historical successes of the last 100 days, contained a little Bannon language.
Right. I mean, I think I have no particular insight over whether Bannon is in or out. I'm generally still sort of like stuck on the fact that Steve Bannon, who's like, the white supremacist, I think we can fairly say, has like a White House office. And it's still disturbing to me how much like collectively we have kind of been like, oh, okay, yeah, totally. White crazy person, white nationalist in the White House, Oval Office seat. Yeah, sure. Let's move on. Same with Sebastian Gorka, right? Like a dude who at best, most charitably, you can say, has ties to Hungarian fascists. Yeah. Like that's the most charitable thing you can say about Sebastian Gorka.
Someone tried to say he was a neo-Nazi online, and I think he's like a paleo-Nazi.
Yeah,
like there's nothing neo about those Hungarian fascists.
The arrow cross was like legit pro-Nazi.
They're OG Nazis.
No, so I don't know if Bannon is in or out. I think what is more relevant is just that like Bannon and Miller, for that matter, still have the ear of the president, right? They still can make a case to Trump, and Trump shows no particular interest in getting rid of either of them. Hmm. And so I think especially in those areas where the president has quite a bit of authority and the press frankly, pays a little less attention to. So around immigration enforcement, around around that, they may still be quite influential. I'm not prepared to say that they're out of the circle.
So topic two is, what is stopping Donald Trump from doing the worst? The premise of topic one was that maybe there were some restraining influences on the inside. But clearly, the big thing has been the opposition in its many forms that has checked Trump. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to talk about now, is what parts of the opposition have been effective, what's been meaningful, and what is the opposition strategy. And see, in fact, I don't even feel like we have to call it the resistance anymore. We can just call it the normal opposition.
Yeah. I'm glad, because the resistance sounds kind of cheesy.
You decided it did. I still don't really love it.
It was sort of self-congratulatory. Yeah, it was kinda, like, we're all wearing berets.
Okay. And, it's sort of like, hey, look, we're all calling our congresspeople now.
There is not consensus about this. I'm not going to nod my head. I still think it sounds
cool. I don't know. I mean,
you've got the resistance jacket on there.
Exactly. You and Steve Bannon. I know.
He's the counter-revolution.
It would be one thing. I think if people are like writing letters to the senators from like forests where they're hiding as partisans, but they're not. So
I mean, I have tweeted and been called like mean names before. So if you think I'm not shedding blood for the resistance, I think that one saving grace about Donald Trump is that he is not an ideologue. So, you know, I really interesting conversation last night with someone about North Korea, and I still think that that peace and prosperity, so issues that are neither red nor blue, right? We can agree that peace is better than war and prosperity is better than poverty. So peace and prosperity were vexed under George W. Bush in ways that I don't think they ever were before. And just due to a president's actions along the lines of nation building and, you know, enormous federal spending. And he just put his head down and did that stuff, even when everything told him not to, even when it was unpopular, even when it was clear it wasn't. He didn't care. He stopped. He didn't have Trump's like craven need for approval or his impulsive changing of direction. He, you know, I think when we were all growing up in the 20th century, that like it was ideology that was the worst thing that you could have in a tyrant. You know, it was a Stalin, a Hitler. I mean, Trump. I don't think that Trump could commit to exterminationist anti-Semitism long enough to pull off even an attack of Poland. You know, he could never see it through, you know?
Right. I mean, our model of authoritarianism is people who want to erase history as opposed to someone who doesn't remember what happened 5 minutes ago.
Right, exactly. That's
for
right.
Literally, there's only the present.
There's only the present moment. Yes. Yeah. And so I think we've been saved a bit by that. I mean, of all the things he defends himself against, the one thing that he almost never takes to Twitter to say to defend himself is the lies. It's just amazing. Like, he just doesn't say, well, I was actually right about this, and here's data to prove it, or it's just, we're on to the next thing.
Let's move on. Yeah. But this is, I want to talk about the opposition here.
Oh, yeah.
Slate did a big survey piece, which had an illustration of Trump tied down like Gulliver, and said it was a long sort of discussion of all the sort of factors that have checked him. And I want to know what you guys think has been important. Has it been the people marching in the streets, you know, which they were doing again this weekend?
Yesterday.
Has it been, you know, Chuck Schumer and the congressional opposition? Has it been, you know, the ACLU and civil society organizations? When you really think about what's blocked this guy, what do you think the big things are? Jamil, you start.
So I think people marching in the streets has actually been really important, right? Like it's very significant that the day after he was inaugurated, the United States saw some of its largest single day protests in its history. And what that did was it gave spine to Democratic lawmakers in particular, who may have felt that they had an obligation to work with the president. Now, I'll say as a parenthetical, the fact that any Democrat, and there certainly some who did think this, might have this thought, is like disgraceful. Like, come on, guys. Like, you just lived through the Obama era. You just lived through the whole Mitch McConnell thing, which worked. So what are you thinking? But all those protests kind of bolstered Democrats who already were feeling like they need to oppose, and then sort of dissuaded more cooperative Democrats from going down that path. I think the other thing, and this, I'm not sure if this is relates to the opposition per se, although the fact that congressional Democrats have pretty much taken a complete sort of, you know, opposition pose to the Trump administration factors into this. It deprives Trump to some degree of a workable majority in the Senate. But just the fact that the time frame for big action from a president is actually really limited, right? Like, there's a reason why 100 days is a bit of an artificial limit, but it does capture something true, which is that after like 3 or 4 months, lawmakers start thinking about reelection, deadlines for things like budgets come up. You start running into intransigence in various parts of the federal government that, like,
your it gets harder, not easier.
Right, your freedom of action limits dramatically, and I think that, you know, that coupled with the stunning incompetence of much of the White House staff has been kind of a natural limit to what they can do, at least legislatively, and even to a certain extent in terms of their like executive action, since for at least a month, no one there was knowledgeable enough to write an executive order that, you know, stood or made sense.
Yeah.
Virginia, who are you thanking when you say grace?
and I do say
I mean,
say
really,
grace.
Who just at a gut level, who do you think, like, have been effective checking this guy?
There, you know, the spectacle on, and we are celebrating 100 days since the Women's March today, and 100 days of resistance, you won't call it, let me call it that, you men patriarchy people. But 100 days into the resistance, the kind of constant spectacle, and I'm going to move from that women's march to me of the town meetings, has been really powerful. And I think especially on the heels of seeing the marches in the red states. When I feel disheartened, I go back and look at, you know, I look at Boise and I look at Des Moines and I look at the people whose resistance has been, I think, in some ways harder than ours on the coast because they're lumped in with Trump voters. And it's just imagined to be a regional, you know, a regional thing. And in some cases, they were only a few percentages under in votes for Hillary. And then they just got erased. So the gaslighting there is very, it's palpable and painful. And when they've gotten to assert themselves in the red states at the town meetings or in those early marches, or when they, as yesterday with the climate march, you know, drive to Washington, come take trains to Washington. I mean, I was on Amtrak yesterday with people coming out from the coming back from the climate march, you know, to Baltimore, to Philadelphia, and they just made their signs and they go down and it's one person, and that's just powerful to see to me. So I guess it is the marches. It also, so I was in the Russia in 1996, and I remember trying to sort of compare notes post-Cold War with some young women there. And they wouldn't let me compare. They just kept saying, it just wasn't normal. It wasn't normal then. It wasn't normal then. And I think the relentless assertion that Trump's not normal, that this is a fringe group that are really in control in the White House, it's a very strange special interest group. I was almost thinking the way there's LGBTQ, we should have initials that are like neo-Nazi skinhead nationalist protectionist. And they could be like, we all support each other in our identity or whatever, because they really are very strange, you know, and it's like this very small, I guess, like the identity politics are going on with the white guys. Like, look at the Women's March, and it's not just a rainbow coalition. It's like we're asking for baseline reassertions of like Magna Carta era stuff, like not anything new, not fancy, not bathrooms. We're down to signs that are like, please respect me, Mr. President, and don't murder me today. You know, there's just like, please, government, don't bulldoze on my town. And that is just like, that is normal. It feels normal. It feels normal to be center left. It feels normal to be a reasonable Republican. And it feels normal to be far left now.
But, you know, just sort of back to my optimism theme, but the white guys I'm feeling kind of grateful to are the framers of the Constitution. Because I think while Trump had a very bad first 100 days, checks and balances had a great 100 days.
Did they really, though?
Yeah. No, really. Let me put the case. You can put the contrary case. But, you know, the Trump's most blatantly unconstitutional orders have been nailed in every federal court and in almost every district in the country. Congress has stood up to him. And the press, the fourth branch, has, I think, performed honestly much better than I expected it to in challenging Trump in a, you know, extraordinary circumstance. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And the surprising thing that's not a check and balance per se is that the executive branch has stood up to the president too. And there's been all sorts of disobedience, leaking, all sorts of undermining of the president, which I think is still, to me, is still a sort of constitutional exercise. The independence of the civil service, the independence of people who have a commitment to the executive branch of government that goes beyond this president. So, but tell me why I'm wrong, like Jamal.
So here's why you're wrong. Congress. So let's checks and balances. Let's look at like the various places. The travel ban, the initial travel ban, didn't go down because it was outside the authority of the president of the United States. It went down because that authority was a little too broadly asserted. But a more competent team in the White House, a fully staffed Office of Legal Counsel, could have crafted an initial travel ban that had much the same effect and would have passed constitutional muster because it's unquestionable that the President of the United States has that kind of authority over immigration and border entering. So this was a problem of sloppiness, not necessarily sort of constitutional overreach. And so I'm not quite sure I'd call that. It's like good that the court said we're going to hold you to a strict standard, right? You got to dot your I's and cross your T's. I always want to say cross your I's and dot your T's because I'm like vaguely dyslexic about aphorisms. Cross your T's, dot your I's. So there's that. With Congress, it's not clear to me that Congress has really stood up to the president much. What seems to have happened is that the Republican majority in the House is more incompetent than we ever could have anticipated. And thank you for clapping for my statement of fact. Is less capable of kind of the basic task of governance. I mean, to that point, this past week, it was an open question whether or not there'd be a government shutdown, despite all branches of government being controlled by the Republican Party. So you have incompetence in the White House, you have incompetence in Congress. That acts in a world where you have to actually be legitimately good at this to get anything done, that acts as its own barrier. But it's very easy to me to imagine a politician with Trump's aims and objectives, or, you know, who translates Trump's impulses into aims and objectives and is methodical and grounded and is able basically to do all the terrible things we were worried about and have them and do them in such a way that, you know, the Republican Congress doesn't push back. The courts say, hey, this checks out as far as like constitutional muster goes, and that, in fact, checks and balances don't assert themselves. I think an evidence for this is that the Republican Congress doesn't especially care that the Trump White House or Donald Trump is like enriching himself on all these trips, right? Like, is directly putting taxpayer dollars into his own pockets, which is like legitimately unconstitutional. Like, you can't do that. There aren't actually that many impeachable offenses on paper, but that's totally one of them. And the fact that Republicans in Congress have been utterly uninterested in this suggests to me that a more competent Donald Trump, like, let's say we had like a Marine Le Pen in the United States. So let's say Ivanka Trump becomes president in 12 years. And once that sort of
ethno-national... it's going to be Jared. It's going to be Ivanka.
Ivanka. It's going to be kind of queen regent Ivanka.
Finally,
Trump.
Finally a female president. I mean, we've been waiting. That glass ceiling.
Boy, is she going to move a lot of jewelry then.
It's just, I don't know. I'm skeptical that what we're looking at is sort of the genius of the founders, and I think it's more just like everyone underestimated how bad at this this particular government would be.
Yeah. Well, there is certainly. Thank you. I agree with you, Jamal, that there has been no accountability within his party in Congress, and that you could say it's shocking, but it's not shocking. But when you look at Congress, the opposition party in Congress, and when you look at the courts, you know, these decisions on the travel ban, they cited his words. I mean, it was what he indicated to be the purpose of what he was doing rather than just the sloppy drafting. Those same opinions could apply even if they had drafted it more carefully and dotted the T's and crossed the I's.
I also think the judges don't want to uphold the travel ban. I mean, it doesn't. You know, it was really, I keep saying this conversation that you had on Trumpcast about the articles of impeachment was really powerful, because a lot of this is, like, that's just wrong, the travel ban. And I feel like judges looked at it and they were, you know, they were basically just saying no. You know, Priebus said today something about, like, we might introduce a constitutional amendment to inhibit the freedom of the press.
He said, we've looked at that.
We've looked at that, right? We have a committee looking into it.
We've looked at changing the First Amendment.
Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't get John McCain standing up and cheering. It's just where they're just like, I'm going to duck and cover, and nobody, and Paul Ryan's not going to say, following in on that, I really want to, I have my red pen out here for the First Amendment also. They're just,
I don't know if I give Paul Ryan that much credit.
It's not his issue, you know, but I do think that there's like some hardwired, respect for the Bill of Rights, at least that you see coming out with the judges and in Congress.
So here's a question. Insofar that bureaucrats and judges are sort of like embodying kind of, you know, pluralism and kind of the American values we most hold dear in their approach to the Trump administration, I'm like happy with that substantive outcome. But does it bother either of you that, like, you can easily imagine a reverse scenario with, like, a mainstream, let's say Bernie Sanders just became president of the United States and wanted to do things that were within his authority but saw resistance from bureaucrats who decided they were going to slow walk or even sabotage what he was trying to do. Like, that's a problem. Like, for as much as Trump is terrible, it is also within our constitutional order that presidents the federal government and the executive branch carries out his instructions and his policy. And a part of me, and I would like to hear what you guys think, a part of me is bothered by this kind of internal executive branch resistance. Just for the sake of, like,
but that is part of what it is, Jamel. Part of it is people being upstanding citizens and opposing a guy they think is a potential autocrat. But part of it is just the molasses nature of bureaucracy,
right?
And they resist any change, and they resisted Obama, and they resisted Clinton, not out of ideology, but because bureaucracies like to keep doing things the way they've been doing them. And I agree with you that if you're on the side of change, that's deeply frustrating. And if you don't like the change, it's kind of reassuring. But it is one of the evolved checks in the system that you can't turn the federal government on a dime and say, here are all our new policies, go do them.
Right.
You have to kind of figure out where those levers are to make
the
bureaucracy
work. But it does
work.
Suggest that the federal government is not working and maybe hasn't. That would be the other weird thing we'd be here talking about, is that we have a president who cares who he is, who's done nothing in the first 100 days. It's just, that's a weird thing to belong to a country that has, that's a ghost ship, or that's, I don't know what the analogy is, but that's just, that's not running. It's just not moving. Like, we're happy because the pilot's dead. Like, that's because he sucked. But yeah, it's still, that's still not, you know, that's not great.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think that was set up under Obama? Like, you were saying this stuck molasses system isn't a good thing.
So, I mean, I guess I think that, like I said earlier, the lack of action is a function more of, ultimately, this is all a function of just, like, White House incompetence. What's the stat right now? That something like over 500 appointed positions in the executive branch don't even have nominees, right? That's like a, that's like not even amateur hour. That's like maybe they just didn't know, right? Like they didn't know that they had to hire all these people,
right?
And they haven't.
In that quick conversation with Obama,
they didn't expect to win,
right?
I mean, they didn't have a bunch of names ready to go.
And so, you know, that's gonna make it hard to exercise your will in the executive branch, and that's probably one reason why things are moving as slow as molasses. But I don't know, to kind of restate.
So do you think that, I mean, now for some reason I'm like newly fixated on George W. Bush. I mean, did that administration work?
It did. No, I mean, it worked insofar that like the principles of the Bush administration had a particular kind of like vision of government that they wanted to execute, and they attempted to do it. The problem was that vision of government was like a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of their plans ended up failing, or many of them failed, because like they were hyper ideological and untethered to like fact and considered judgment. But they attempted to do it, right? That's actually like the genius of Dick Cheney, is the thing that makes him like a mustache twirling villain, is that he sort of understood that personnel is policy, and used his influence to get as many Cheneyites into the bureaucracy as he possibly could, for the express purpose of steering things in that direction.
If you really know how it works, if you're Dick Cheney, who was a political scientist who spent his whole career studying how the government worked, it was really hard to make things happen.
Right. True.
If you're Jared Kushner showing up from New York with a real estate portfolio that you're trying to promote, forget it.
Yeah.
They're not going to work for you.
This sounds really radical to me. I mean, the slight suggestion that this system hasn't worked for a long time, and when it does work, it looks like George W. Bush.
Well, doesn't work is a little strong, Virginia. I think it's hard to move in a directionally.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the point is, it continues to work the way it's been working. You show up and say, here's what I think the Department of Education should be doing. Mm-hmm. If you're Betsy DeVos, I think we should have vouchers and we could change everything. And most of the people at the Department of Education put their heads down and say, that's very nice, Betsy DeVos.
Yeah.
Now we're going to get back to running all the programs we run.
Yeah.
And unless you have legislation, which you don't, you can't make us do that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact that Trump has catalyzed this complete audit on the part of all of us, but also of what democracy is, what the Constitution is, what the executive branch's responsibilities are and how it works, has been a very powerful change, and potentially, and I don't want to be optimistic, but potentially a salubrious one for the body politic, a healthy one for us that we're doing all this, you know, like really looking at brass tacks on all these things. And, you know, Trump is such a good brander, and, you know, he put Betsy DeVos in, and maybe it's just like a coat of paint to say, now we believe in vouchers and the kingdom of heaven. What is her ideology again? I mean, her thing, it is a kingdom anyway, that we're going to start teaching that in schools, and then nobody does it, and then we move on. You know, it's a layer
of... But you appease the base that cares about it by making noise about it, even though nothing happens.
I guess before we move on, I still want to say, it still does bother me that if Betsy DeVos, we want vouchers, and it is within the mission of the Department of Education. Doesn't have like a super well-defined mission, but it's not counter to the mission of the Department of Education to look for alternative funding mechanisms for different kinds of schools. And if DOE bureaucrats said, yeah, that's nice, we're not going to do it, I think that'd be a problem. Like, this is a bit different than, say, with the EPA, whose mission very much is environmental protection. If Scott Pruitt says, I want you to look for places where we can drill for oil, and bureaucrats said, yeah, no, I think that's a bit more defensible, right? Because, like, Scott Pruitt is ordering something in direct contradiction of the mission of that agency.
Mm.
But if something fits within the mission of the agency, and it's just that, like, the bureaucrats think it's too hard, or, like, they politically may have a problem with it, it bothers me that they wouldn't do it, even though...
I think you're making a great point, and it's the we'll come back to Hannah's point, and there are already things that have, right? I mean, Obama's use of executive orders because Congress was so uncooperative, has now expanded the range of motion that Trump can use with executive orders. And you have to be, it's the key point, you know, you can't be for the filibuster when it helps you and against the filibuster when it hurts your side. You have to find some neutral principles about how you think the government should work.
Right.
Let's move on and talk for a few minutes about the press.
Yeah.
I was reading one of these 100 days story the other day in the Wall Street Journal. There was a quote from Newt Gingrich, who is every once in a while says something really strangely insightful. And the quote was, Donald Trump is an existentialist. He lives entirely in the moment.
That's not what that means.
But what it, I think it was, well, he's not an existentialist. What it means is what you were saying before, Virginia, that Trump doesn't think about what he said 10 minutes ago. He doesn't care if you call him a liar. He doesn't care about inconsistency. Mm. He is totally improvising 100% of the time with no sense of the past, not much sense of the future. But the whole way the press usually holds someone accountable, which is, you said this and now you're saying this. You promised to do this and now you're not doing that. You did this instead. Doesn't matter to him.
I mean, it's
so the question is, if I think Newt Gingrich onto a little something, just sort of diagnosing how Trump thinks, how do you, as a journalist, Jamel, why don't you start with this? How do you hold someone accountable who doesn't feel accountable in any conventional way to his own statements past positions?
Right. He seems to exist outside like the space-time continuum relative to the rest of us. He's like a Q in politics.
It's just what's happening now.
TNG fans out there.
I'm glad somebody got that reference. I was
like hoping someone would.
Was that science fiction?
Yes.
I know that.
So my general approach to this has been to like pay attention to like the concrete things happening, the actual people, right? Like I don't know. I mean, first of all, Trump is certainly not reading me, so it's not like I could not like anything I say is going to weigh on anyone in that administration. But in terms of readers, focusing on what's happening to people and pointing out the ways in which the inexperience and incompetence of the White House have like hampered their freedom of movement, I think is important. But for the kinds of people that Trump does listen to, like the New York Times, for example, I don't know how one covers someone who is oblivious or contemptuous of even the idea of accountability. Or how do you even cover someone whose words don't seem to mean anything? I mean, earlier in the evening, we spoke about how he's reversed himself on so many things and how in one breath he'll say, you know, I'm going to withdraw from NATO. The next breath said, I'm not going to do that. At a certain point, does the words of the President of the United States actually hold any weight or meaning? Or are they just kind of like, you know, debris in the air? That we have to avoid.
Debris in the air, that's it. You'd be embarrassed. He's not. He's just not embarrassed. He doesn't care that he changes his position by the minute. And it seems to be, at some level, effective politically, because there is a group of people, a core group of his supporters, who don't mind that he does that. In fact, they kind of like that he's improvising all the time and seems like doing what seems like a good idea at the moment.
You know, there's this, I think existentialism is probably the wrong word, but I mean, who knows? Existentialism, nobody really knew what that was anyway. But I think what he's describing as a former full, you just know what it is.
I think it's
but not my word, it's Newt's word.
As a one-time philosophy major myself, I think that he's describing something called solipsism of the present moment, which is, you know, first, as we can probably guess from Trump, this is not at all a psychological diagnosis, but just more a philosophical position that I think he doesn't believe in the existence of other minds. Like he doesn't act as though he does.
Yeah.
And then that it's the present moment. And when in philosophy classes, probably lots of you know this, when someone starts making an argument that maybe we are all just brains in vats and our experience is being simulated and it's a projection of the present moment and it's all ever changing, that argument is disqualified from conversation. Because if you decide to put that in place, you've just flipped the game board and walked away. You had a tantrum. It's not fair play, and it's not even language. So language is not binding anymore. You know, it's sometimes kids, teenagers do this, are right. just like, well, it's all bullshit anyway, or whatever. So there is an, you know, he brings that out in you with this kind of action that, like, you know, that's the original reductio ad absurdum, is you start, so it's very frustrating to try to cover with ordinary language someone who's defies even the terms of the most standard language game, and obviously feels no shame in the face of you know, pathological lying, constant lying. But here's the problem, and this goes back to your articles of impeachment thing. In a person, if you have an underperforming executive or you have a husband who is talks like that, you know, people are advised to treat it as though it was noise and nonsense, because to the extent that you get hooked into any of it, you're lost. You know, you're getting all these reactions provoked because it lands to you, we got to get out of NATO. Suddenly you think, here's what's going to happen. We don't have this alliance anymore, and the Pax Americana is over and whatever. And then the next day he's back in NATO. So why did you, like, let this cortisol thing happen? And worse than that, maybe take action on something that he was about to reverse on. So you're supposed to just sit that out. But he's the president. Right, his exactly. speech is not like our speech. Like, you know, we can say whatever palaver we say up here, and it doesn't move markets, and it doesn't trigger North Korea, and it doesn't send everybody into spirals, and they can take it or leave it. But, you know, I think in that conversation you had with Noah Feldman, you came up with some interesting ideas about what the president's speech is and how it's different from ordinary
well,
speech.
Well, Noah Feldman makes the argument that because the historical evolved meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors. First of all, crimes and misdemeanors means the same thing. But it's essentially wrongdoing by the president, the person who has high office.
And this, or anyone is, with this high, is kind of moral wrongdoing. I mean,
yeah, and that, and there's no other remedy. You can't sue the president for libel. You can't sue him for any other kinds of... The only remedy is impeachment. And of course, impeachment doesn't mean he's removed from office. But if you're impeached, and Noah Feldman makes, you know, a very strong argument, which I don't happen to agree with, but he makes a strong argument that Trump's attacks on the press, the things he said, not only are not protected by the First Amendment in a conventional way, but are abuses of office
and impeachable.
And it would be should be articles of impeachment. It's a very interesting argument. But I think what you're saying, I mean, first of all, Virginia, that was brilliant. That was great. I don't know. But it frames the problem, I think, exactly the way we're facing it, is that you do have a president who is so not playing by the normal rules of logic, discourse, consistency, that it is a reductio ad absurdum. And if he's saying, I don't care about any of that, I'm just doing what I'm doing right now, there isn't really any remedy. I mean, there's no way to relate to that. And what the press tends to keep doing is, in a very responsible way, calling him on it. Mm. You lied again. You've lied 17 times today. You've changed your position on NATO. You know, here and here, and here's what you said. But the president, his advisors, and 40% of the country aren't interested.
Yeah. And one of the things, I don't know if any of you saw Will Ferrell's impression of George W. Bush on the Samantha Bee show last night, but...
You were representing Trumpcast.
Yes, I represent Trumpcast, and they shouted us out for our really hard-hitting work doing MeUndies ads. Pulitzer is on its way, I think. You know, one of the things that Ferrell as Bush said is... you know, I'm half inclined to try to do my impersonation, but I
Go
will
for
spare
it.
You. He said,
do you
know, you all, you all in the press used to ask me these gotcha questions, like, why are we going to war? gotcha. and he said, if only I had known that I could just say fake news whenever you ask me a question. And it's true. Bush at least stammered out an answer, like he felt he had to say something. Why are we going to war? Where Trump would just say fake news. I mean, it is, anyway, it's, I think one very immediate remedy is to leave him off the front page.
Yeah.
Just a weird idea, but it's just start with other stories.
No, I mean, I think that's right. I think if you're faced with a president who has decided that that words essentially have no meaning, the weight of what he says carries no actual communication, then just don't put him on A1 anymore. Like, have just like a compendium in the back of the paper that's like, hey, this is what Trump said today.
Yeah.
It's on A18. You can check it out if you want.
Yeah.
And otherwise, no,
Trump's Twitter corner.
Right.
And it would be like this weird thing on A7.
I mean, one thing that sort of troubles me is sort of on this kind of like philosophical, you know, public discourse note, is that part of the reason why the words of the president are supposed to carry so much weight is that the president is the only elected representative of the people constituted, however you want to constitute them, right? That like, that's where the president's moral legitimacy and authority comes from. Mm. That, like, I represent the American people who elected me. If Trump's words contain no meaning and carry no information, is there anyone actually speaking for the public, for the body politic? Like, are we in this era? Is part of what feels so discombobulating about this the fact that we actually don't, in a critical sense, have a president? We just have like this guy
saying shit that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But the problem is,
and there must have been kings. I just feel like there's a monarch. There's an analogy with a monarchy that I'm just not, you know, with King George or with just like there's people have had insane leaders for millennia, right? And who don't represent the people and don't even say they do, and speak to their sect. You know, even at his rallies, he's only talking about himself as the president of his base.
Right.
But anyway, there must be a way to survive it.
Yeah, I mean, if everyone agrees that it means nothing, that's good. That works. But I'm concerned that Kim Jong-un might still think
exactly.
It means something.
Right, right.
You know, and the Chinese seem to have figured out it doesn't.
Yes.
And, you know,
which thank God for it, you know?
I know I'm like the solipsist of the present moment. I am switching my positions. But I a little bit think that it's possible that people outside America understand it better. Because the Chinese were really quick to read the Taiwan thing and not get affronted at it and just decide, oh, we've got another one of there's another autocrat, you know, with a hot temper, and we know how to deal with that before. I mean,
Xi Jinping played that brilliantly. He didn't rise to the bait, and then he said, basically, call us when your tantrum is over.
Yeah.
We will take your call when you're done.
I mean, it's possible that we are just still such earnest Puritans that we're like, but he's mean and he says things that aren't true. And everybody else has had a leader like this, you know, and it's our turn.
We're going to do a lightning round now before we go to questions. And the lightning round is because he has proposed a tax cut, which we should not call tax reform because it's not tax reform. It's going to have a lot of financial implications. And I'm now going to ask you guys for your best investment advice for the second 100 days. So what with your 401k, your little nest egg, do you go long on? What do you go short on based on what you think is going to happen in the Trump presidency? Jamel, you start out. This is like, we're like CNBC now.
Right. I'm always never entirely clear what like terms like long and short mean. So I'm going to...
Long means you're buying it. Short means you're selling
it. I'm selling it.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm shorting the ability for any legislation to get passed, right? I just like, I'm skeptical. The easiest thing that could happen on tax cuts is like, they just like, you know, they just cut taxes for rich people for 10 years and like let it sunset after that, like they did with the Bush tax cuts. I'm not even sure that's going to happen, honestly. Like I'm skeptical. So I'm going to short, I guess, the Trump administration and the Congress passing a large tax cut. And so going along with this is something that I hope to make money on. It's a great question.
So you're going to invest in based on what you think is going to happen. What's a good investment? If you think Trump's tax cut isn't going to happen,
right?
It's not a great time to start a hedge fund.
I feel like that my only thing for going long on is just going to be really depressing. I'm going to go long on the Justice Department just like pretending like police shootings don't happen. Right? Just
I don't know how you arbitrage that, but
yeah, me neither. Just Jeff Sessions, like, I mean, Jeff Sessions already says, right, that like the problem in American policing is that people just don't respect cops enough, right? So like more of that I would put money on.
I think I knew you were going to ask this. I'm trying to fudge the question a little bit too. But I,
you guys are never going to be on CNBC.
No, I know. Yeah. You're right. We should be angling for those gigs. It's also hard to, isn't it hard to think about money the way you used to? I don't know. I keep getting swamped by politics. But I do have an actual answer. I am short tech. I just think that Silicon Valley, it is just like a miserable time, and the venture community is reeling also. And you know, I don't know exactly what that means. It looks like TWTR Twitter is up, which is amazing. I think we've asked. As a sidebar, I think we've asked way, way too much of, you know, a little microblogging platform that was meant to, you know, talk about where to get a beer in Austin, Texas, and now is moving mountains and is like a centerpiece of geopolitics. It's like
they get us all killed.
It's asking like nodes of Rubik's cubes to like, you know, to you know, manage world history. And then I think, you know, places obviously like Uber that are not public, but are currently disasters. And then as far as what I'm long, New York Times Company is still a public company. it is very, the life around the media and the Fourth Estate, if not the money, is very powerful right now. It really is. And you know when George Jefferson used to like rainy days because people do their dry cleaning on rainy days or whatever? I mean, it's true that the press like does well when there's... Look, we thought we needed millennials or we needed a digital strategy in the media. What we needed was a mighty story. What we needed was what Melville said you needed, which is to have a mighty story. You need a mighty subject. We have a mighty subject right now. And so many things derive from it. It's visceral. There's moral battle in it. And I'd invest in the media.
All right. We're going to take a few questions. I'm going to give you investment advice in a minute. But while I think of my investment advice, yeah, put your hands up. And my investment advice, so that's buy the New York Times, sell Twitter.
Yep.
That's your long Justice Department abuse. I mean, that's a little hard to trade on. Mine's simple. You're long China because we are ceding power and influence to them at a rapid rate. And investments in China long term are going to thrive. And short, I'm afraid to say, American markets, because the so-called Trump trade, which is investments made, the stock market is up almost 15% since the election. The reason for that is partly that people think these tax cuts, which are going to allow companies to pay a lower tax rate and bring all sorts of capital back to this country, people think that has a chance of passing. I think that has not such a good chance of passing right now.
Just with a straight Jacob face, he just said, sell out your own country and plow it into a hostile foreign power.
Learn.
Questions?
It's just investment advice. We're going to start right here in the third row. And do we have microphones? Yes. Yeah, so wait till you have the microphone. Tell us who you are if you have a...
My name is Valerie. And my brief question is about your thoughts on how... Like you were talking about the protests in places like Boise and, you know, red states, but those are all cities. And cities are increasingly concentrations of like-minded, left-leaning people, and they're getting sort of politically more and more isolated from the surrounding areas. Even in New York, I mean, a lot of upstate is, you know, pretty solidly Trump country. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how to sort of blend them together and what is the remedy for that disconnect between cities and the states that they're in?
Virginia, heal the rural-urban divide, please.
I think rural America has been incoherent and in trouble for a long time. I mean, I'm from New Hampshire. I'm from a small town, granted an academic town. Jamel lives in shortly to live in not the capital city of the state of Virginia. And I don't know. You know, if Boise is too urban, if it, like, to fit this model, or the capitals of welfare states like Montana, the places that had marches, I don't know what to do with the small towns or the small municipalities. I don't know what is happening to agribusiness. It wasn't a focus of the campaign. The towns that, you know, Trump uses all these proxies, but when he was trying to talk about flyover states or red states, what he knew about them, he would sometimes gesture at Detroit, which was a proxy for black, and then it suddenly became about drugs and ruination and carnage. And then the other thing he would say, he didn't ever talk about farmers, to my knowledge. I think he only ever would then talk about, you know, the Rust Belt or this fantasy of what the mines looked like. Sort of a dodge, but I think Jamel's incredible piece for Slate, where he points out that it's retail workers in small cities and exurbs and suburbs, not in rural areas, but that really are suffering from unemployment, and that they're people of color and women. But as for people in rural areas, they're just such a small population in truly rural areas. Someone can tell me otherwise. I don't think either side addressed them in the campaigns, and I'm sure they feel underrepresented at every level, including in the state legislature.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, one thing to think about is sort of when people who live in big cities like New York, D.C., Chicago, L.A., et cetera, talk about the rural-urban divide, I think they often imagine that the people on the rural side are thinking about them. But it's more likely that they're thinking about the nearest, largest town in the vicinity, right? So, like, down in southwestern Virginia, if you're in Bath County, Virginia, like, the city for you might just be like Bristol, Virginia, or might be Martinsville, Virginia, but sure, places with, like, you know, 80, 90, 100,000 people, but they're not like the cities as we conceive of them necessarily. I think maybe the key to maybe bridging the urban-rural divide, or at least like making making liberal blue lefty politics like more viable across expanse of land, is to plow resources in these small cities, largest towns that are the focal points for a lot of otherwise rural counties, but are kind of like lost in the mix. So that's like one thought. The second is that there are plenty of places in the country where rural America is actually pretty hospitable to lefty politics. And those places are places where the rural population is disproportionately black and Latino. Like one in five rural counties are majority black and Latino. And they're basically kind of like forgotten counties in American politics, right? Because like when we think about when we say rural, typically what we're thinking about are like, you know, blue collar white workers in the middle of nowhere. And so that's sort of like the frame for rural politics. And then we think about non-white politics in terms of urban areas. But there's actually like there are a lot of brown people. And, you know, my family, my extended family all lives in like the middle of nowhere in South Georgia and the Florida Panhandle. And they live in places that are like mostly black, and they're very rural, and they're basically ignored by political establishments in their states and certainly nationally. And kind of like making investments in places like those isn't going to like fix your problem, but you'll begin to get headway if you at least have some kind of political presence in those areas of the country.
We got to wrap this up. Who wants the last question of the Tribeca Film Festival? I see a hand. I'm pointing at you, sir. Can you see me right there? Yes, you.
Hi, my name is Jonathan. Assuming the world doesn't end in the next 610 days, what's your prognostication for what happens after the midterm elections, and how does Trump world evolve in January 2019?
Great last question. I mean, I'll start that one out by saying I think it depends on those 24 seats, right? I mean, I think if Democrats retake the House, it's a very long shot they would take back the Senate. But if they have the House, they have subpoena power, they have the power of investigation. I think if Democrats take the House, there are going to be impeachment proceedings. I think it's highly likely. And whether Trump is removed from office or not, I think that's what the second half of his term would be about. And if they don't take the House, I think none of that will happen, and it will be pretty much the way it is now. So that's my prognostication.
You go, Jamal.
Yeah, I don't think mine's much different. I mean, it all kind of just hinges on if Dems take the House. And if they do, I mean, if they do, right, if they take the House and then they say don't take the Senate, which, like Jacob, I think is pretty, I think a twofer is pretty unlikely. I would expect Republican senators to begin, like, panicking, right? That, like, all of a sudden they realize the ground under their feet is rapidly shifting, and that would induce some kind of behavior changes. I don't know what they would be. But yeah. But Democrats will probably be very aggressive with the subpoena power if they get the House. And I don't know what Team Trump will do. This assumes, like, Team Trump will be kind of, like, intact at that point. I don't know. You know, we may see some people leave. Some people go to jail. I don't know.
Well, we're all cheering for President Pence at this point.
Are we, though? Are we?
Just that it would suggest impeachment. Spare us that idea that it's a possibility.
That's it for tonight's show, which has come to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've been live from the Tribeca Film Festival, and I want to thank Jason DeLeon, Jason Gambrell, Steve Lichtai, Andy Bowers, June Thomas, Kirsten Holtz, Tatiana Flowers, Andrew Essex, and Jane Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast. For Jamal Bowie and Virginia Heffernan, I'm Jacob Weisberg.